The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
$2 trillion, that's the size of Deutsche Bank's balance sheet. It's so big that it's more than half of the size of the German economy. So if Deutsche Bank gets into trouble, well, that could do major damage to Europe's biggest member. In fact, the IMF has recently called Deutsche Bank the biggest single risk to the entire global banking system. And things aren't looking great. Profits at the bank have collapsed and its shares have plummeted. The current crisis was sparked by news that the US wants $14 billion to settle misconduct charges that go all the way back to the financial crisis. Deutsche says that it won't pay anywhere near as much as that, but it was still enough to spook investors and also to prompt German media to report that a state bailout could be on the way. Both the bank and Angela Merkel's government have denied that they've discussed a rescue package. Profits were already under pressure even before that. Tougher regulation has squeezed Deutsche Bank's investment banking business, and low interest rates have made it hard to make money. The bank isn't standing still, though. Its new CEO, John Kryon, has been selling operations, cutting jobs, and also freezing dividend payments. But will it be enough? Well, that is the $2 trillion question.
That's Nina DeSantos, a report on CNN Money just today. And I know that Richard Palmer, who was filling in yesterday, he covered this at the top of the show, and as he said there, this is the most important story of the week, really, that hasn't received nearly enough attention. Germany, I mean, to this point, it's been the financial rock of Europe, and all of the problems that Greece and others in the South have faced, Germany's managed to avoid so much of that. It's been seen as a rock of stability for Europe's economy. And now look at the trouble it's in, as she explained in that report. Here, Deutsche Bank is half the size of the German economy, and the IMF is saying it's the single greatest risk now. Not just to Germany and its economy, but to the global economy. We've been pointing out this message or this article from George Friedman in recent programs, saying that if Germany weakens or if Germany destabilizes economically, well, then all of Europe goes along with it. It's building to a crisis. I mean, it may not happen today. The bank may not go under today. But we can certainly see where this is headed. And as Richard Palmer brought out yesterday, I think he did. He's going to be touching on this in an article for the Trumpet.com here in the next few days as well. But it's not just Deutsche Bank. It's Commerzbank as well. And so where is it leading? Well, it was Herbert Armstrong, as you probably know, who talked about a financial crisis in Europe that would help to bring the kings together, that would bring Europe together. And we know there's lots of restructuring that's yet to go on as it's whittled down to those 10 kings, that mixture of iron and clay. This clip here that I'll play for you, it's Mr. Armstrong talking about that prophecy in Daniel 2, the Daniel 2 image, and the final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, those 10 toes, that iron and clay mixture. Here's what he said. This is from a sermon in the 1980s, clip 6.
And in the days of these kings, those toes which represent a nation to be formed, as I told you, in Europe when they go together. Now they're trying to form that now, and this economic crisis may be the thing that'll plunge them into it. And in the days of these kings, that's the ones that maybe will rise up in the next year or two or three, or whatever, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. In their days, God will set up a kingdom, which will be, of course, the kingdom of God, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. That's the kingdoms that'll be in Europe and that are on the earth today. And it shall stand forever.
That's Herbert Armstrong from the 1980s, speaking in the middle of that clip there about an economic crisis and how that it may be the thing that brings them all together. It's what they've wanted. And, of course, we're 30 years on from that clip. And Europe has, in a sense, come together, but there are still some dramatic changes to take place. And will this economic crisis bring together those ten kings? In that Friedman article, he said there's a growing sense in Germany that the German system is failing. I mean, that's speaking of the political system primarily. But he also touched on, in that article, on Germany's economy. And that as Germany's economy goes, so goes Europe's. Here there's this growing sense that the system in Germany's failing. I mean, things are being set up perfectly for a strong man to emerge. And this is something we've covered, well, quite often. Brad McDonald's piece from September 9th. I've referred to this twice, I think, already. He talked about the multiple crises that are converging to put such enormous pressure on Germany's post-war political system. So we're looking at a major political crisis. We're looking at a major economic crisis. We're looking at a major crisis with the immigration problem. And then, of course, all of the dangers from abroad. Not just the immigration problem alone. But you can certainly feel it building. And like Richard Palmer said yesterday, if this is a huge development and it's gone underreported, we need to be talking about it. We need to be keeping our eyes on what's happening in Europe and in Germany in particular. There was this piece from, I forget the source, it's one of the German publications that was translated in our news bureau, about the German culture. More and more Germans speaking up, saying that they want immigrants to blend into German culture. They want them to become distinctly German, more than just in citizenship only. This article here says, I think it quotes from the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, if I'm not mistaken. In any event, it says, once again, in the Federal Republic, a dominant culture debate is raging. It began with the statement of the former German president, Christian Wolff, who claimed that Islam is a part of Germany. It was escalated with Pegida and the refugee crisis last summer. It was fueled in state elections by the success of the AfD and receives extra weight from the CSU, which wants to anchor a dominant culture in the Bavarian Constitution. Some of these things we've talked about before, but this article goes on to talk about this survey that was taken where 57% of respondents believe that there is such a thing as national character. You know, we do, in Germany, we do have a national character, and we want to preserve that. That's a pretty large majority, 57%. And then in that same poll, 53% fear that this national character is increasingly lost. And so they're getting concerned. Here's another crisis. A crisis that's forming. And then what about this one? A total of 76% of respondents therefore demand that foreigners living in Germany should be oriented towards the German culture. See, this goes far beyond just the formal citizenship. If they're going to come into Germany, if they're going to live in our country, then they need to be oriented towards the German culture. And so look at all of these crises converging. You know all about the recent elections in Berlin and elsewhere. Now you add Deutsche Bank to it. I mean, it's one after another. It's like something new or additional each week. That's in Germany. in the United States, sticking with the economy here, there was an article, I guess just yesterday, in the Washington Post about the Obama administration using an obscure fund to pay billions of dollars to insurers in the Affordable Care Act. The Post says here, the Obama administration is maneuvering to pay health insurers billions of dollars the government owes under the Affordable Care Act through a move that could circumvent Congress and help shore up the president's signature legislation, or rather signature legislative achievement, before he leaves office. So he's got a few months left. The Affordable Care Act is on life support. It's been a total disaster. It's broken every promise on which it was established. And here's the president now frantically trying to salvage the program by paying off the insurance carriers and doing it in a way that circumvents, once again, Congress. It says here, Justice Department officials have privately told several health plans suing over unpaid money that they are eager to negotiate a broad settlement, which could end up offering payments to about 175 health plans selling coverage on ACA marketplaces, according to insurance executives and lawyers familiar with the talks. The payments most likely would draw from an obscure Treasury Department fund intended to cover federal legal claims, the executives and lawyers said. The approach would get around a recent congressional ban on the use of health and human services money to pay the insurers. Well, there's a ban there. Well, that's all right. Let's go around it. Here's another opportunity for executive action. It says the start of negotiations came amid an exodus of health plans from the insurance exchanges that are at the heart of the law. More than 10 million Americans have gained coverage through the marketplaces since they opened in 2014, but many insurers are losing money on their new customers, who tend to be relatively sick and expensive to treat. As a result, some smaller plans have been driven out of business, and a few major ones are defecting from exchanges for the coming year. And so here is another big government program that started out with so many pie-in-the-sky promises, and now the reality is setting in. And what's the solution to this ever-expanding problem? Well, of course, it's always to throw more money at it. It's always to give more money. And if we put more money into it, then the problem will be solved. How much longer before America is Deutsche Bank? Well, America is already Deutsche Bank. America's worse than Deutsche Bank. And as soon as the creditors come calling, well, we're going to see a collapse of epic proportions. Just keep spending away. $20 trillion in federal debt? Never mind. Just keep spending and look for some obscure fund tucked away in the Treasury where they're printing off more and more dollars. And just pay them off. Pay the bills. Prop it up. Keep it alive. Keep the Affordable Care Act alive. It's his legacy, after all. Shifting gears here just for a second. I thought this was interesting last night. I saw this tweet to this piece in the Jerusalem Post. We talked a fair bit about Shimon Peres. His funeral's today, by the way, in Jerusalem. But we talked about him and his relationship with Herbert Armstrong and the negotiating that Israel has done with the Palestinians since the late 1980s, the early 1990s. And this is from the Jerusalem Post yesterday. It says here, if not for Shimon Peres's intervention, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was planning to bomb Iran, the former president revealed confidentially to the Jerusalem Post over 2 years ago. It says here, in a meeting at the Peres Center for Peace in Jaffa on August 24th, 2014, Peres dropped the bombshell in a conversation with me and Jerusalem Post managing editor David Brin. I failed to write down the name of the author, the me in that sentence. It says here there was a three individuals involved in this conversation, these two reporters and then Mr. Perez. I thought long and hard, this journalist says, about whether to publish it, and reached the conclusion that he wouldn't have told us if he didn't want us to. I was editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post at the time and had established a close relationship with Perez, who had retired a month earlier as president. During the course of the conversation, in which just the three of us sat and chatted over coffee, Brin asked Perez what he considered the greatest achievement of his presidency. He responded by saying that he had personally intervened to stop Netanyahu from ordering a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear sites. So, I mean, this is just based upon what two reporters supposedly heard 2 years ago, so I guess we can't put too much stock into it. But as I tried to bring out on Wednesday, I mean, when you look at the life of Shimon Peres and the hawk that he was early on, building up or helping to build up Israel's formidable military force and even its nuclear program, and then turning to the dove that he was in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, where he was reaching out to the Palestinians and in particular working with Yasser Arafat, who had been labeled a terrorist up to that point. And then evidently later on in his life, much later in his life, he was instrumental in helping to stop Israel from going forward with a strike on Iran. I just thought it was interesting because obviously if that would have happened, it would have significantly altered the landscape in the Middle East. And given what we know about Bible prophecy, particularly the rise of the King of the South and the clash between the King of the South and the King of the North, and all that we've seen happen even this year with the disastrous Iran nuke deal, well, it may be, it just may be that God did not want that strike to happen. There is a strike coming. It's prophesied. But it's going to be coming from Europe. Now, we can't go out on a limb and say that Israel will never lash out. I mean, something like that could happen, I suppose. But it looks less and less likely. And what we know will happen, what we definitely know will happen, is that a German-led combine will come against the King of the South, like a whirlwind, just as Daniel 11 and verse 40 says. That is coming. You can certainly see, just like with respect to these stories about Germany, all of these crises, you can certainly see it. You can feel it building to the clash. One final piece here in this segment. This is from thespectator.co.uk, titled Putin's Covert War on Western Decadence. This article here is astounding to me. It says Russia is being presented as a moral fortress against gays and pornography. And then notice what it says here. This is from The Spectator here in the UK. Last weekend, a group of young activists turned out on a Moscow street to protest against Western decadence. They were a hard-faced bunch, standing defiantly in military poses and wearing uniforms bearing the logo Officers of Russia, Executive Youth Wing, as they blocked access to an exhibition by American photographer Jock Sturgis that featured images of nude adolescents. Nude adolescents on display in Moscow, thanks to an American photographer who's doing his part to export filth to as many faraway places as possible. And you have Russian activists who are protesting against this. Good for them. Good for them. But what does it say about the United States? How embarrassing this ought to be. This article says here, we're here to protect, quotes one of the officers, we're here to protect people from pedophilic influences. He told journalists, while another protester sprayed the offending photographs with urine. It says, at the same time, Russia's state-controlled airways filled with senators, priests, and government officials denouncing the wickedness of the exhibition, which shut down immediately after the protests. So they were able to shut it down. And they called for the organizers to be prosecuted. It says the outcry came just days after the Russian government banned two popular pornography sites, also on the grounds of protecting public morality. You may not have known about this development. Here's the Russian strong-arm government banning two popular pornography sites. It says Putin's Russia is fast becoming a very Puritan place. Well, I don't know about that, but in any event, it certainly is correcting the United States. Manasa, sadly, it takes a Russian dictator to help us begin to see what we're exporting, the kind of filth that we're exporting. It says, ever since returning to the presidency in 2012, Putin has pursued an increasingly religious, conservative ideology, both at home and abroad, defining Russia as a moral fortress against sexual license and decadence, porn, and gay rights. Here's the Prince of Rosh. He's got his problems, obviously. He's on a rampage right now, pushing through Ukraine, gobbling up what he can, little by little. And yet at home in Moscow, he's trying to clean it up some, morally. But how embarrassing that Israel, that the nations of Israel, you think about what God prophesies about our people. Isaiah 3, for one, it says, the show of their countenance does witness against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they've rewarded evil unto themselves. God says, we, Manasseh, Ephraim, we're out there declaring our sin, just like Sodom. We're so proud of what we produce, even if it's nude adolescents. Pictures of nude adolescents. We've got to export it. We've got to take it out to the rest of the world. We've got to show them the wonders of freedom. That's what we think. When I saw this story, it made me think of that program my father did in 2011, 5 years ago now, where he referred to that letter from Osama bin Laden. Here again, a deranged murderer, but one that talked about the filth coming out of Western nations. Here's one clip from that particular Key of David program my father gave. This is clip 7.
The United States spreads its pornographic movies and obscene music around the earth through the internet. America and Britain have the best technology in the world. And also, they both have the most pornography, and especially America. But I wrote, we are better equipped than any nation has ever been to deliver a message. But our message to the world is dominated by the worst pornographic filth humanity has ever seen. It is America's number one worldwide business. Depraved music is our number two export. The world is full of violence and ready to explode into nuclear warfare, and America's strongest messages to the world is the filthiest Satan-inspired trash ever seen and heard. Now, those are strong words, but let me just think about this for a moment. Please think about it and get the picture here. We're facing as our number one problem human survival. Human survival. And here we have the greatest technology in all of the world, and America's number one message or export is pornographic material. That's our number one message to the world.
And then he goes on to quote from what Osama bin Laden said about all the lies and immorality and debauchery that comes out from the West. And my father brings out how we have this unbelievable platform, all this technology, to deliver a message. And look at what we're out there spreading. Look at our number one export. I'm reminded, too, of a visit we had last year to Blenheim Palace, just an hour down the road here from Edstone. This place where Winston Churchill spent much of his time as an adult, studying, painting. He proposed to his wife there. There's a wonderful exhibit at this palace on Churchill. I've been through it twice now, but the first time we went through that exhibit, and then we worked our way through the palace, and toward the end of the tour of the palace, they have this huge exhibit, this art exhibit, this photographer with all of his pictures on display, and every single picture that he had taken from all over the world, all of these iconic scenes, he put his hand in the foreground with an obscene gesture on every single one of the photographs. In this huge, magnificent room inside of a palace. We told one of the attendants there how offensive it was, and she seemed embarrassed herself that all those photos were on display at Blenheim Palace. But you also saw in her face, well, what can you do? What can you do? Free speech. We've got to put it on display. Just like this photographer in Moscow. Well, I've got to take my pictures of nude children. Nude children! Pornography! And we've just got to spread it as far as we can. What a platform we have if we'd use the technology we have to actually set an example for the world. That's what God intended from the beginning. You go back to ancient Israel, it's history. He brought them out of Egyptian bondage, and he said to them, look, I want you now to be a model nation. I want you to be a kind of a national showcase. I want you to be an example that the surrounding Gentile nations can see and learn from. I want for them to be able to see God's laws in action. I want for them to see the practical benefits to obeying those laws on a national scale. And Moses explained to the Israelites this awesome responsibility that they had as they were entering into the promised land. Read it in Deuteronomy 4 and elsewhere. And yet, what did Israel consistently do? They failed to measure up to this high calling. They didn't hold fast to God's laws. This was their most valuable asset, God's laws. They rebelled against them instead. And they went and borrowed the pagan ideas and customs of the surrounding Gentile nations. It's all there in the Old Testament. Well, here we are today, and it's even worse than that. We've taken on all the customs, all the ideas, all the pagan traditions of surrounding nations. And now it's so bad, it's so filthy, what we're exporting, that you have surrounding nations. You have terrorists, you have tyrants saying, that's enough with this filth. We don't want it in Moscow. We don't want it in Iran or wherever. What a shame. What must God think of our example today? Well, we can take this and certainly learn a lot from it on the individual level as well, because a true Christian is a follower of Jesus Christ. We follow his example, and we're meant to be lights in this very dark world. Paul said to Timothy, let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers. It doesn't matter that you're so young, Timothy. Don't worry about it. Don't be insecure. Just set an example. Set an example for God's people. Set an example in your conduct. Show them the way to go. Paul, all through his writings, we've been going through this in class, all through his writings, he told the brethren, look, just follow me. Imitate me. Follow my steps. Follow me as I follow Christ. That's the idea here. That's what this world needs, an example, a godly example. They're certainly not seeing it in the United States or Britain. Here we were meant to be putting God's way of life on display. And instead, look at what we export. He said to Timothy, till I come, give attendance to reading, exhortation, to doctrine. And it said in verse 15, this is 1 Timothy 4:15, meditate on these things, give yourself wholly to them, that your profiting may appear to all. See, pour your heart into this way of life, and if you do so, then your profiting may appear to everyone. Everyone will see it. They can see the example and then follow in that example. Well, he said some of the same things to Titus, where he admonished him, another ministerial assistant or an assistant in the ministry. He said to Titus, show yourself a pattern of good works. A pattern. That word translated for pattern in Titus 2. It's defined as a figure formed by a blow or impression. The pattern in conformity to which a thing must be made. An example to be imitated. That's the responsibility that God gives to us. And we have our weaknesses and faults, our sins to overcome. We've made our mistakes. But on the other hand, what a responsibility we have to establish the pattern, to show yourself a pattern of good works, to be an example to the believers and the unbelievers, for that matter, to be a light, as Jesus said, a light to this world. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us. That's your weekend assignment. As always, we give it to you on Friday morning in Oklahoma, Friday afternoon in the UK. Send us a note. Tell us how you listen. Tell us what you think of the program. Tell us where you come from. We'd like to know all of that, and we'll try to get to some of those comments on the air sometime next week. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
Yesterday I was doing a little bit of research that took me to the middle of the autobiography, Herbert W. Armstrong's autobiography. I mentioned this new book that we printed. It's not a new book, I guess, but it's newly printed by the Philadelphia Church of God. I talked about how beautiful it is and how they did a great job in Edmond, and someone has since brought to my attention that the book was actually paid for, or the printing of it was paid for by our supporters in Canada. So that was headed up by the Canadian Regional Office. But if you haven't gotten your copy of Herbert W. Armstrong's autobiography, then contact one of our regional offices, the one nearest you, and get your free copy of that book today. It's been sitting on my shelf. I keep eyeing it. And yesterday, finally, I've been wanting to start going through it again. And so yesterday I got through a couple of chapters in the middle. I was going back to just the start of the work as it began back in 1933 and 1934 with Mr. Armstrong going on radio and then starting The Plain Truth in January, February of that year, 1934. And so then finally I thought, well, okay, I've gotten through this and I really want to go back and start from the beginning. And so I did that. This morning, lots of valuable instruction. That's what struck me about those chapters in the middle that I read yesterday. I mean, there's a lot there about Herbert Armstrong's life and, of course, the establishment of God's work during the Philadelphia era. But there is so much in there that comes straight out of the Bible, as you're seeing how the Bible impacted Mr. Armstrong's life. And maybe there's not as much of that in the earlier chapters because that was before his conversion to the truth. But still, what a fascinating read to read there in that first chapter of the autobiography about a 16-year-old, a teenager, in the early years of the 20th century, getting a summer job at a hotel in a little town called Altoona, Iowa, just outside of Des Moines. And it was at that hotel as a 16-year-old, and some of you are aware of this story, that Mr. Armstrong experienced this spark of ambition. His boss there at the hotel, a single man of about 45 years of age, he noticed young Herbert. He noticed this teenager, this 16-year-old. And in the autobiography, it says, soon he began to tell me, this is the hotel manager, he began to tell Mr. Armstrong that he could see qualities in me that were destined to carry me to large success in life. He constantly expressed great confidence in me and what I would be able to accomplish if I were willing to put forth the effort. That's what he wrote in the autobiography. Here's how Mr. Armstrong explained it in a message from 1984. This is clip one.
But at age 16, I had the first job of my life away from home, and the man I was working for would put his arm on my shoulder and tell me how well I was working and what my performance, it was very good, and that he could see in me abilities, and that he knew I would go places in the world. And he kept telling me this kind of thing and encouraging me, and somehow he aroused ambition in me. And I came to realize that ambition was just two things. Of course, it's a desire to succeed and to have, but also it is the resolution to work and to produce that desired result. And it doesn't come easy, and I knew that.
It doesn't come easy. Prior to this time, Mr. Armstrong, well, he just saw himself as an average Joe. He didn't apply himself much anyway at school. He didn't see himself as a big leader. He explains in his autobiography that he mostly followed around the older boys. But at that time, during that summer job, this hotel manager had aroused in Mr. Armstrong this ambitious desire to truly make something of his life. He wrote, "It's impossible to estimate the importance of this sudden arousal of ambition, this injection of an intense desire for success." He said, "This igniting of the spark of determined energy to achieve worthy accomplishment, this was the turning point of my life." This was the turning point of his life. Now, those chapters I read in the middle of the book, they were about a turning point for God's work. And then I go back to the beginning of the book this morning, and here's the turning point of his life. This was something that got him finally moving. He says, "This was the turning point of my life. Suddenly, life became a whole new ball game. There had awakened within a totally new outlook on the future." And then he said this, again, valuable instruction for all of us, not just young people, but certainly for young people too. He says, "This, I believe, is the vital ingredient that has been missing in most human lives. Most continue through life as I was prior to this arousal of ambition. The idea of looking forward to achieving success or an accomplishment of any note never intruded itself into my mind, nor does it probably in the average mind. And it was like an intrusion, for my mind was uninterruptedly occupied only with the interests, pleasures, and enjoyments of the moment." And that's the way it is for so many, as he explained. Much more so today. Our minds to just be uninterruptedly occupied with the interests, pleasures, and enjoyments of the moment. But at the age of 16, way back in what would it have been, 1908, I guess, Mr. Armstrong experienced this sudden, abrupt change. This spark of ambition had been ignited. And from that point forward, Mr. Armstrong drove himself. He drove himself forward with diligent, earnest effort to work hard to achieve success. And, of course, vanity motivated some of that as well. But when God finally crushed the vanity and brought him to the point of conversion, well, Mr. Armstrong kept right on driving himself, only in the direction of God and God's work. He brought that same drive and determination, that resourcefulness, that perseverance, all these laws of success. We'll have to get into that in another segment. But he brought that with him into God's work, into serving God. And he really did educate himself in God's way of life. Of course, prior to the conversion point, he went out and educated himself in the field of advertising, as he wanted to go out and make a name for himself in the world of advertising, and he did do that. And then all of that drive, that ambition, that desire, it was transferred over to serve God, and he continued with his education in God's way of life. Here's another clip where Mr. Armstrong talks about his early education, or just education in general. This is clip number 2.
An education consists of study, it consists of thinking, it consists of mixing minds with other people, it consists of travel, it consists of observation and thinking and action. And so I decided that I had the ambition and the desire to work, and I would get my education in that way.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1984, talking about his early life, his teen years. That's right at the beginning of chapter 2 in the autobiography. You've got the opening introduction is a phenomenal read as well, where it just talks about the work today, well, as it was at the time near the end of Mr. Armstrong's life, and where it all started. And then you get into chapter 1, his boyhood years, and this spark of ambition that's discussed at the end of that chapter, and then the start, the very start of chapter 2, where it talks about true education, really. Mr. Armstrong, as an older teen, seeking guidance and direction from his Uncle Frank before getting into the field of advertising. And he wrote in the autobiography, education, you heard some of this in the clip we just played, education comes from study, from books, from lectures, from contacts, from travel, from thinking about what you see and hear and read, and from experience. The reason we have to maintain schools and universities is simply that most people are too lazy, most lack the ambition and the persistence, the drive to procure an education outside of schools and colleges. That's the advice that his Uncle Frank gave to him. Most just don't have the drive to push themselves, and so they need the structure of a formal education. They need someone constantly cracking the whip on them. Well, you go back to that passage I read in the first segment, where Paul said to Timothy to set an example for the brethren. It says here in 1 Thessalonians 4:11, and that you study to be quiet, and to do your business, and to work with your own hands, as we commanded you. See, lead a quiet life, Timothy, and keep studying. Be studious. Do your business. Work with your hands. Set an example. Isn't that something this world needs? How unique God's people are. How unique God's children are. If they're following this instruction. Here's another clip from Herbert Armstrong. This is from a message he gave in 1983, clip 4.
Most young men never think about having a goal. They never think about what are they going to do when they grow up. They never think about what kind of work are they going to do, what kind of occupation or what kind of profession will they get into. Or if they do, they just think, well, I'd like to be a dentist, I'd like to be a doctor, I'd like to be a lawyer, and they decide to go to a school. And maybe the one who decides to be a lawyer would be better talented and equipped and have more ability to become a doctor. Well, when I was 18 years of age, I put myself through a self-examination by a book I found in the public library that examined whatever abilities or talents, if any, and what weaknesses and shortcomings and faults I had. And also, it went through a complete examination of the professions, the occupations, the different jobs, to see where those particular talents or abilities fit and where those weaknesses and handicaps did not seem to do so much harm. Now, I didn't choose just the right profession, because the one that I should have chosen, I didn't know yet until God called me. I had no way of knowing it at the time. But what I did choose, I think God guided me in, because it prepared me for and gave me the experience that I needed when I did start the real profession that God later did call me to.
Now, this is all discussed in the autobiography. Again, go through this book. If you haven't gotten a copy yet, get one. But set aside some time, perhaps this winter, to make this a reading assignment for you, or maybe for your young people, your children. But God was guiding him. This is talked about in the first part of chapter 2, where he was reading Choosing a Vocation. This is when he's 18 now. He had the spark of ambition at 16. And then at 18, he did some study to determine what it is he should get into. And, of course, God wouldn't call him until some years later. But even as he got into advertising, as he explained there, he knew, or now knew in hindsight, that God had guided him to prepare him for what he would be doing in service to God later. Going back to this instruction from the Apostle Paul, study to be quiet, do your business, work with your hands, that you may walk honestly or reputably. Here again, the example. Walk honestly or reputably toward them that are without, and that you may have lack of nothing. You see, you've got to set an example for those who are without, or on the outside, in other words. This is what the world needs. We're the light of this world. Jesus said, let your light so shine. In the Proverbs 3, it says, happy is the man that finds wisdom and the man that gets understanding. See, wisdom and understanding, they're out there, but you have to go seek after it. You have to go get it. If you bring God into your education, if you really work to establish that solid spiritual foundation first, there's plenty of wisdom and understanding to obtain. Paul said in Romans, the depth and riches. And what we've been going through of late in 1 Corinthians, and this is brought out in Colossians and in other passages as well. Paul repeatedly talking about the mysteries that have been hidden, the mysteries that can now be made known to you. If we're prepared to really dig in to our education, spiritually speaking, and get God involved and get God to where he's guiding us. This example in Acts 17 we've referred to quite often, the example with the Bereans who were searching the scriptures daily, as it says there in that passage, to see whether or not those things were so, those things that Paul was preaching to them. And Paul said, look, those people were more noble than the ones in Thessalonica just because of their study habits, just because of their approach to education. You can see in those early chapters of the autobiography, God really involved in Mr. Armstrong's education. Even his education for his career in advertising, it turned out to be short-lived. But God was preparing him. God was guiding him for his calling, for his conversion that would come sometime later. I think it was some 20 years later. He says, again, this is from switching back to the first chapter of the autobiography. Some few years later, I was considerably inspired by one of Orison Swett Marden's inspiration books titled He Can Who Thinks He Can. And Mr. Armstrong said, what a pity that there seems to be a famine of such books today. You just don't see them today, books like this. And you get some insights in the first couple of chapters of the autobiography. You get some insights into what it was Mr. Armstrong studied, what he was reading, what he was digging into. And a lot of the time it was autobiographies or biographies. Ben Franklin's, of course, stood out in his mind. And then other ones, inspirational books like the He Can Who Thinks He Can. But he read a lot of biographies about great individuals of history. And all that helped to keep that spark of ambition alive, to keep that flame burning. Lots and lots about true education, at least in the general liberal arts, right there in those first couple chapters of the autobiography. He says later, as a young man, I read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography 3 times over a period of a few years. It had a considerable impact and influence on my life. I owe much to having read it. He said, the reading of life experiences of many other men, whether biography or autobiography, have been of great value and inspiration. And then he mentioned Bernard Baruch, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Benjamin Franklin. They all had an impact. Well, and it's amazing when you move further on into the story and you see the educational institutions that he raised up, Ambassador College, and then now Armstrong College. We've followed in his same footsteps. And you see some of these influences from early on in his life. They're still there in God's educational system, together with the foundation of all knowledge, which, of course, is the Holy Bible. Mr. Armstrong, I'll play one last clip for you. This is him talking about, I think, a young lady who came to AC. That was one of her goals. This is one that we'll save for another segment. Again, the seven laws of success. In any event, it talks about this gal who came to AC, and she was floundering a bit once she got there. This is clip three.
You know, some time back, I found several students here at Ambassador College just floundering around. Their grades were going down. Professors began to report it to me. But I found the reason. When I talked to these students, they had no objective. There was no purpose. You know, if you're not interested in what you're doing, you're not going to do it well. If you have a goal, then you're interested in what you're doing. You know where you're going, and you want to keep on till you get there. Yes, first in order of the seven rules of success is to have a right goal in life. Not any goal, the right goal. Aim in life that will inspire ambition, that will move you on to success. I remember one girl we had that had a goal before she came to Ambassador College, and we found she was bogging down here. She didn't have any goal. She said her goal had been accomplished. The only goal in life she had was to get to come to Ambassador College. Now she was here, her goal was accomplished. Well, we had to show her a bigger goal ahead. It's going to take her the rest of her life to find it. I think she's on her way now.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old radio programs, opening up about some of the issues he dealt with young people at AC. And you can see, even in that clip there, when you go back and study the first few chapters of his own autobiography, you can see how God was working with him, even as a teenager, inspiring ambition and helping him to be goal-oriented, and all of it in preparation for his conversion to the truth, something that would come some two decades later. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this weekend. That's td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week.